The Oklahoma Geological Survey has concluded that it's very likely that the many earthquakes in that state are triggered by wastewater from oil and gas exploration. Last year, we spoke with a state seismologist who was looking into the reason behind the many earthquakes. Today, the conclusion and a website to track the drilling. Joe Wurst is a reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. Joe, remind us how water comes to be used in gas and oil exploration.
So when you drill down to get the oil and gas, up comes the oil, and with it comes a lot of water, especially in Oklahoma. Oklahoma wells notoriously produce a ton of water. And oil and gas companies have to do something with this water. They don't want it. They want the oil and gas. But they can't just throw the water away. It's toxic. Since it's been down deep underground, deep in the earth, it's salty. It's got chemicals and stuff in it, little bits of oil and gas in it. So they have to do something with it. And most of the oil and gas rules in place in states have to do with safe drinking water. So they've devised a way to make sure that that waste fluid doesn't get anywhere near the drinking water. So they've just been injecting it back underground, pumping it deep into these wells called disposal wells or injection wells.
And this is just in traditional oil and gas exploration, not to be confused with fracking, which is a relatively new technique of injecting water into things like rock shale to break it up.
Right. So fracking is something that's synonymous with water and synonymous with fluid, right? So you pump a bunch of fluid mixed with sand down into a rock formation and break it up and release oil and gas. That produces water too, and fracking fluid can be toxic as well. In Oklahoma, it's both, although most of the water that we're producing in oil and gas in Oklahoma is just from regular drilling. But the fracking fluid gets the same treatment. If it's not recycled, and a relatively small percentage of it is, it's injected. It's disposed of deep underground.
Well, and now your geological survey is concluding that this water is responsible for what we are hearing is called a swarm of earthquakes, 585 quakes in 2014, up from 109 in 2013, much more. The state averaged two a year in 2008 before the oil and gas industry began to boom in Oklahoma. How does it feel there to have this many earthquakes?
People are nervous. You know, it's important to note that most of these quakes are relatively small, but a lot of these are threes. You know, that's a magnitude three most people can feel. And we've had some larger ones. We're starting to get more magnitude fours. In 2011, we had a magnitude 5.6, magnitude 5.7. That was a big earthquake, and it caused some damage and injured a couple people, you know, toppled a spire on a nearby university. So people are worried about it, and regulators and researchers have been racing to try to understand the situation better.
Well, now that the Geological Survey feels they've come to this confirmation of many people's suspicions that it is the injection of wastewater into the ground, into these wells, what's been the response? Start with the oil companies.
They're saying further study is needed, and that's something scientists agree with. You know, Oklahoma is the epicenter, really, of trying to understand this phenomenon. But what the oil and gas industry is really worried about is overregulation of these disposal wells. We've had some lawmakers in Oklahoma call for a moratorium. Certainly some everyday citizens speaking up in meetings have called for a moratorium on these wells, too. Oil and gas industry doesn't want all these wells to just get a blanket shut down. They're key to the industry, and they say essentially that if there are no disposal wells, there is no oil and gas drilling in Oklahoma. And that's, you know, really the primary economic driver here in Oklahoma.
Well, we mentioned your own state geological survey has a new website out. They've got maps showing people where these wells are. The U.S. Geological Survey is coming out with new hazard maps this week. How will that help states like Oklahoma?
Well, insurance companies, public safety officials, building designers, construction people, they have to account for earthquakes and be able to forecast earthquakes in order to protect the public safety, design buildings that can tolerate shaking. So they rely on the U.S. Geological Survey to produce these hazard maps that show and forecast where there might be some shaking. And these artificial earthquakes in Oklahoma and other states like Texas, Ohio, Colorado, it's hard to account for artificial earthquakes because everything that they've built as far as these hazard predictions relies upon historical earthquakes and ones that are natural. So they're better at predicting natural earthquakes than these ones that are artificial. And the USGS is updating its models to account for this so people can plan to make things safer.
Joe Wurst, reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. Fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the mayor of Los Angeles has just detailed a new partnership with the traffic app Waze to try and improve congestion in L.A. The city will get real-time data about traffic patterns and road conditions in exchange for providing Waze with details of road closures, construction, and film shoots that affect L.A. streets. In San Francisco, officials are also turning to technology rather than construction to mitigate traffic on I-80. They're calling it the I-80 Smart Corridor Project, and it involves mainly electronic signs. Joining us from KQED in San Francisco is Randy Durenberger, the program manager and designer. Randy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Christina Faraz is also with us. She is the I-80 Smart Corridor Project Manager. Christina, good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
And tell us, Christina, about this project. What exactly is it? It's going to be just signs that tell you as a driver what's coming up, whether there's been an accident, whether there's traffic?
So we're going to be installing ramp meters on 44 ramps along the corridor, and we're going to be managing the flow of traffic into the corridor. We have over 1,300 accidents on I-80 on a yearly basis. So when there is an incident, we're going to be turning on electronic signs to inform the drivers that there is an incident ahead and recommending that they slow down, they reduce their speed, because a lot of the accidents on this corridor are due to high speed.
And how is this different from the kinds of things that already exist in cities around the country where I'm sure all drivers have seen signs that say accident ahead?
In our case, we're going to have variable advisory signs. So we're actually going to be changing the speed limit on I-80. And we expect to improve safety by a minimum of 10%. And we also expect to reduce travel time by anywhere between 10 to 15%.
Wow. Randy, how is this different from some of these apps that exist now, like Waze, for example, which calculates traffic data and accidents and even lets you know where police are? It lets drivers sort of talk to one another.
Sure. What we're expecting is that this information along this corridor will provide drivers an even more real-time set of information as they're traveling through the corridor so that they know at precisely the point where they can be expected to start slowing down for congestion that's ahead of them, and also giving them information on which lane they should be in. Also, when drivers decide that they might want to get off the freeway to find their way around an incident, these signs will guide them through that corridor and tell them when they can go back to the freeway when they've passed the incident.
Is this all being done by computer, or are there people behind telling drivers what to do here?
There's both computers and people. So what's unique about this project is that the system will prompt a traffic management center operator of the strategy or the changes that should be displayed on signs, and then the operator will confirm that action from the center.
Now, this is a $79 million project, Christina, 133 signs, and this 24-hour traffic management center. Some may ask, would it be better to just either add lanes to the road or add some other ways for people to get around, put more money into public transit instead of putting more money into the highways?
Adding lanes on I-80 would be quite costly. Actually extremely costly, and there would be tremendous environmental impacts and needs for acquisition. So we're talking about $79 million just being a fraction of the cost that it would be to widen the freeway.
As you were designing this project, how much of the traffic that we have right now did you find is avoidable, that with something like this you could actually avoid it?
Well, we certainly saw some areas of the congestion that we felt could be improved through this project. In particular, one of the elements is ramp metering. And by spacing out the platoon of vehicles getting on the freeway, we're able to eliminate some of that stop-and-go congestion that you see where the ramp merges onto the freeway and the freeway traffic has to slow down to let people on.
And we also expect the ramps that will be metered, there will be lanes that will allow buses and high occupancy vehicles to have access to the main line faster.
Christina Faraz and Randy Durenberger, who are in charge of this new smart corridor project on I-80 in the San Francisco Bay Area. And guys, did you have any traffic problems today coming into the studio?
No, we took BART.
Okay. No, wait, is that fair? The highway designers are taking the subway there in San Francisco?
It sure is.
Well, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
If you scan the news headlines today, you'll see several stories about Uber, the app-based car service that is transforming transportation in many places. In Portland, Oregon, the company has just gotten the green light to operate after a close city council vote. In New York, an Uber customer was mistakenly charged $16,000 for a ride from Brooklyn to Manhattan. But in cities like LA and San Francisco, the story is about growth for Uber thanks to a new product called Uber Pool, which matches customers with strangers going in the same direction. As part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, we're joined now from San Francisco by Jeff Holden, the Chief Product Officer for Uber. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us more about Uber Pool. Why would somebody decide to use this instead of just taking a cab or an Uber or walking around?
Right. Well, the sort of gets into the kind of why we're so passionate about this product. What we're trying to do, you know, Uber overall, kind of vision wise, is trying to kind of reinvent cities from a transportation perspective, make transportation ubiquitous, inexpensive, to the point where people no longer need to own cars. And in order for that to happen, you need to get the price point down to a level that it makes economic sense to take an Uber all the time.
And you think Uber is too expensive right now?
No, I'm not saying that at all. But we're relentlessly lowering price. So it's actually very interesting. If UberX, if you drive 5,000 miles a year or less, and with some assumptions about the cost of your car and so forth, UberX is actually about $3,500 cheaper to take the same trips, so two times a day for those 5,000 miles. It's cheaper than owning your car. Now, if you take the number of miles up to 10,000, then that's where Uber Pool comes into the equation, because Uber Pool is up to 50% less expensive than UberX to take, which gets to your question of why would you take this? Is much cheaper, and so for the for the little bit of time difference in getting from point A to point B and sharing a vehicle with someone else, you save a lot of money, and we're really excited about that because of the macro effect of lowering prices overall for transportation.
But if you're saving money, that means that the person who would be getting the money is getting less. Is this worthwhile for an Uber driver? Maybe there's an Uber driver listening to this right now. Is it worthwhile for them to go this route and decide to do Uber Pool instead of just doing Uber or UberX?
It's a great question. It's actually better than worthwhile. So the thing to keep in mind initially is that both riders are paying for their portion of the trip. And so it's actually if you just put two people in the car and charge them exactly half for the part that they overlap, then the driver would get exactly the same money. But the beauty of Uber Pool is it's also more efficient for the driver. So you tend to be on trip a larger percentage of the kind of minutes of an hour. And so as a result, you can actually make more. I mean, and we're always targeting a certain income level that we want to make sure that we keep achieve at a certain minimum level for drivers. And we wouldn't do Uber Pool if it compromised that.
And one of your rivals, Lyft, has developed something similar called Lyft Line. But with both of these services, I guess the next question is, what about the person you're going to be sitting next to? You obviously can vet drivers, but you can't vet the other passengers.
Yeah, I mean that was kind of the grand social experiment of Uber Pool, and it's something we're really excited about and interested in, to seeing kind of where it goes, and just sort of straightforward Uber style, we just put it out there and to see kind of what happened, and what we've gotten is universally just really positive feedback. And we have some fun anecdotes, of course, as you'd imagine. Like we had a couple actually get engaged after meeting in Uber Pool a couple months later. We've had people get land job interviews and get jobs and job offers as a result of conversations stations in New Liverpool. In fact, that happened to me. I rode New Liverpool recently, and there was a guy who was about to go to – he was on his way to an interview for another company, and I convinced him to interview with us. And so, that, you know, it's sort of a recruiting tool in some ways. But, it, you know, the thing that's really interesting about it is that it's a serendipitous encounter with another human. And you never know where those things will lead. And they can be, you know, they can be great, you know. And we've just had no kind of feedback of any kind of negativity around it. So far, the grand social experiment is really positive.
And so far, it's being done in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Paris, New York, and Austin, Texas, where South by Southwest was. Where is the next spot for Uberpool?
We haven't announced it or even picked it yet. We're basically in those cities that we're in today. We're sort of learning and getting the model right, and then you know, kind of Uber's you know, style is to you know is to sort of then go big. And so there's a lot of interesting things to figure out with Uberpool before you can do that, because it's sort of a network business inside of a network business. You have to get you have to have enough density of rider requests, so that you can pair those people, on trips. And so it's figuring out how to get people to adopt Uberpool, how to do the pricing, et cetera, is all stuff that needs to be figured out. And we've made great progress with that. But we'll, stay tuned. We'll have some great announcements for you soon in terms of rolling out Uberpool. We've talked about launching soon in London and in a couple other places, but we haven't, firmed up any of those plans yet.
What about regulations? Back in September, the California Public Utilities Commission sent a letter to Uber that asserted that state law prohibits what are known as charter party carriers from charging fares to individuals rather than charging a total amount to all passengers, which is how Uberpool operates. Are you going to run into problems with regulations, which you have with just regular old Uber products in cities where this has disrupted their traditional taxi cab industry?
Yeah, I mean this actually it's obviously Uber is constantly dealing with regulatory challenges because what we're doing is unprecedented. And there's in the 20s now of various districts that have passed kind of what we refer to as smart kind of ride sharing legislation that makes it so Uber can operate kind of well within the white of the law on this on ride sharing. With Uberpool specifically, it's interesting because it actually has so many benefits to it. It's an extremely clear example of removing cars from the road and truly decongesting cities. So that, from a regulatory perspective, is always very interesting. From a regulatory perspective, and then what's advantageous for cities, and all of the things come together in determining whether things will be blocked or not. So far, we're having great success with Uberpool, and we haven't had any hard blocks on being able to continue growing the product.
We're speaking with Jeff Holden, the chief product officer for Uber. And Jeff Holden, as the chief product officer, when you see some of the stories in the news that say, an Uber driver has gotten in trouble for burglarizing the home of somebody that they just took to the airport, or these stories that you've seen, do you think to yourself, oh, the media are just picking on us, or people are just angry with Uber because we're changing the way that the taxi cabs in these cities work? Or do you think, oh, we've got to do a better job of vetting these people?
Oh, it's a combination of both things. I mean, we're certainly kind of in the spotlight, because of the sort of incredible kind of hyper growth of the company, and that makes us interesting to talk about, and people would rather talk about plane crashes and safe landings and all that good stuff. But safety is our top priority. I mean, it's just, sort of hands down. And any sort of safety related issue for Uber, we take extremely seriously, whether it's covered in the press or not. I mean, it's much more about the efficacy of what we're doing than the optics. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that at Uber scale, something that will happen one in a million times, if you do something millions and millions of times, and we're doing over a million trips a day today, in fact, over 2 million at New Year's, you're going to have, those kind of very low probability events that occur. So what we're trying to do is drive those down continuously and be the absolute safest ride in any city, the safest place you can be in any city. That's how we think about it.
Where do you see the growth? Is it in things like Uberpool that add services to large cities that are already places where Uber is very popular? Or is it expanding Uber into smaller and smaller and smaller cities all over the world?
The expansion of Uber itself is definitely the core of our growth right now, since we're only still in, you know, 4 cities and a little bit in Austin, as you mentioned. So Uber Pool is still very nascent, so it's not a key driver of our growth yet. Now, we're also only in like about a quarter of the world's largest cities. So we moved out of the U.S. and we started expanding in all these international cities, and it's exploding even faster in international cities, many international cities, than in any of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. But we're still it's not just a matter of expanding into smaller cities. We're still expanding into large cities. So it's still very, very early days for Uber in many ways.
Well, how do you adapt to a place that is all the way around the world and operates in a very different way than where you are, San Francisco? How do you go into India or something like that and say, we're going to make our product work here just the way it does somewhere else?
Yeah, actually, you know, our approach to that is to have, you know, people on the ground in all of these cities, operations teams, and they are you know, citizens of the city, so they know the city. They're you know, woven into the mesh of it, and they kind of live and breathe it every single day. And it differs from city to city. We don't just try to kind of ram the, you know, kind of the Uber way down every single city's throat. But, you know, the way they communicate, for example, if you look at a place like China, people just don't use text messaging and email. They use chat services, and so. So if you don't, you know, figure that out and incorporate that into your service, you're not relevant.
Do self-driving cars scare you for the future of Uber?
No, they don't scare me. They're definitely that's the future. Like, there's no question that's coming, and we think it's many, many years in the future. You know, we're certainly
more than 10 years, you think, or.
Yeah, before it's a serious contributor to like kind of transportation in the kind of the Uber way and kind of the ride sharing world, it's definitely that kind of time frame. What's going to happen even before autonomous vehicles is you're going to be in a world where ride sharing will be the way people get around. So, you know, that revolution, I think, is going to happen, you know, and sort of run to completion or run to a very mature point first. And so then when you start substituting in, you know, self-driving cars, they're just basically doing the same thing but self-driving. And so that's kind of how I think that plays out. And owning your own self-driving car, I think, will be, or, you know, even owning your own car will be a hobby/luxury thing.
Jeff Holden, Chief Product Officer for Uber, joining us from San Francisco. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Jeremy.
This week, 60 Minutes is defending its decision to air what it called some of the most disturbing footage in its 47-year history. And a warning, we're about to air a few seconds of it. The audio is difficult, but the video is of Syrians, including children, dying horribly from a sarin gas attack in 2013.
Victims were stripped and washed. Everything was tried, but nothing could be done.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent. He's got some thoughts on these images. David, share them. How did you feel about this airing?
Well, look, I think the key thing to remember is that so much of journalism involves a subjective choices. And that word carries a certain kinds of negative connotations. People say, oh, that's not objective journalism. Well, these are tough choices to make. And at the same time, you know, you saw people, including youth, children, shaking, quivering, twitching, mm-hmm. some of them clearly, you know, about to die. Mm-hmm. And it was very effective and it was very moving. And you can say, well, look, that was 2 years ago. Why should we care about this now? And the whole point of, I think, the story was of subjective choice to say, whatever our policy is as a government, as a people, you know, you should care about this. This is happening. This is a problem. And it's a terrible reflection of what that government is willing to do on itself there in Syria.
Well, CBS reporter Scott Pelley said the network didn't question the decision to air it.
We wanted the world to see what this was in all of its ugliness. It killed more than 1,000 people, more than 400 children. You can read about that all day, but if you don't see it, I don't believe the impact truly hits you.
And David, you know, people are saying this is the appropriate response to, say, sanitizing the news or hiding it, you know, not showing coffins coming back from war. But on the other hand, does this also anesthetize us to it?
Well, it's a question of how much you show these things. You know, if American networks were to decide to show beheadings by ISIS every time ISIS decided to post footage up on YouTube, it would essentially be serving in the eyes of many media observers, many journalists, in effect as a part of a propaganda arm of ISIS. In so doing, Fox News came under much criticism for showing the full execution of that footage, I believe only online, but still. And yet, you know, in some ways you have to give some sense of the barbarity of what's involved for people to understand it. People wrestled with, for example, showing footage of a police officer being killed in Paris as part of those Charlie Hebdo attacks by Muslim extremists there. And it was very moving and very visceral. But, you know, we knew that the guy was dead. Did we need to see him shot? I think that's a borderline call.
Yeah. Well, then there's also the recent videos of black men being shot in the U.S. And killed on video. Yes, it triggered a national outcry, but some are also wondering, wait a second, is there something obscene about watching death between commercials?
Well, I talked a little bit with Bruce Shapiro about that. He's director of the DART Center, which thinks about how violence is portrayed by journalists. I personally think that that footage, particularly of Walter Scott in North Charleston being shot six times, you know, again, in the back as he fled, not particularly quickly, a police officer in North Charleston, South Carolina. I thought that that was served to, you know, enshrine an understanding of what really happened rather than having police saying this is regrettable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a struggle and you have to understand it in that context. I think at times camera, particularly citizen-generated photographs that are not done by professional journalists, are vital to us filling in pictures that were otherwise sanitized by official explanations.
Yeah. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, something tells me we will be talking about this again and again, the use of very graphic videos. David, thank you.
You bet.
Today is Earth Day. Lots going on around the world to celebrate. A group of hikers cleaned up trash today along the Great Wall of China. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, volunteers and local breweries drilled rain barrels to catch and conserve water this morning. In Des Moines, Iowa, people are spending the afternoon cleaning up and planting trees across the city. For his part, President Obama is spending some time in the Florida Everglades today with Bill Nye, the science guy, to draw attention to the effects of climate change. But in the Florida Keys, it's not climate change that has some scientists concerned as authorities prepare to issue new regulations to protect coral reef there. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WLRN's Nancy Klingener reports from Key West on a study with some surprising findings.
Jeremy Jackson was the lead scientist on a survey that looked at the health of coral reefs in the Caribbean over the last 50 years. He said climate change is not the biggest threat facing coral reefs.
The two strongest factors, given all the data available, are overfishing and just simply too many people.
That's a real problem for the Keys, Jackson says.
You have 5 million people living next door who come down and use it as their backyard pool.
Jackson delivered his report to the fishermen, divers, tourism promoters, and conservationists who serve as local advisors to the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. Fishing is not allowed in about 6% of the Keys sanctuary. Jackson said that number should be more like 30%, and the areas should ban all uses, including diving. Jackson said the Keys should also stop development and limit tourism. Those are politically unlikely scenarios. I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
So, what are you doing for Earth Day? And it doesn't have to be something you do outside. Maybe you should think about conserving in your own kitchen. That's what food journalist Eugenia Bone does. She saves food that people would normally throw away, like peach pits or broccoli stems, and uses them to make tasty dishes. She shares her recipes and her philosophy in a new book called The Kitchen Ecosystem, Integrating Recipes to Create Delicious Meals. And she joins us now to talk about it. Eugenia Bone, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And let's define our terms here. What is a kitchen ecosystem to you?
Well, I started to see parallels between natural ecosystems and my kitchen. For example, a robust ecosystem, natural ecosystem, is the health of that ecosystem is based on the diversity of critters living in it and their sort of dynamic integration. Similarly, a kitchen ecosystem could be described as being only as good as the diversity of homemade and fresh ingredients that you used in a kind of dynamic integration. And additionally, just like a natural ecosystem has no waste, everything cycles back into the system, so too in a kitchen ecosystem, the more you recycled back food waste, which I don't even like to call it food waste, let's call it wasted food, back into your cooking, the better tasting your cooking would be.
That you should use everything.
you should use as much as you can, because and the more you use, the better tasting your food will be, because just like in nature, you get out of the system what you put into it.
And right now, the statistics show we're throwing out about 40% of the food that is grown for human consumption. It is filling up landfills.
Right. It's crazy. And agricultural policy is one thing and grocery store change is another. Those are areas that definitely produce a lot of food waste. But home cooks like you and me, you know, we do it too. And so that's where my area of focus is.
Well, where should we be focusing in our own kitchens? What is it that we are throwing out right now that we could be using to make food that is delicious and looks as good as the stuff in your book?
Well, thank you. Well, it's really, I think, a matter of the way you approach cooking. So if you approach every dinner as a discrete entity, then efficiency is only achieved by buying pre-made stuff and commercial condiments and, you know, already cut up chicken parts. But if you buy the whole food, then you're able to produce meals in sequence and over time. So, for example, if I buy a container of chicken thighs, I can only make dinner with chicken thighs that night. But if I buy a whole chicken, I can cut it up and serve the parts for dinner and then put on a stock with the bones. And it might only produce 2 pints of stock, but so what? You know, that's 2 pints of stock. That's right. What's wrong with that? And then I can make, say, cook spaghettini in the stock the next night. And the efficiency is on multiple levels. One, it's like I'm halfway through with dinner on night two because I've made stock. And it's efficient in terms of your dollars. It's kind of a ripoff to buy parts. And it produces better flavor because you're using these homemade ingredients. And it's more efficient in terms of your carbon footprint because you're not producing this waste.
What about, though, the food that I end up throwing out is the food that I can't use fast enough? I might buy some broccoli and I use it in one meal, but then I have a little bit too much. And the next day, maybe I don't want broccoli. And the day after that, I'm out to dinner or I'm doing something else. What do you do with that kind of thing that sort of it's perfectly good for a time, but not after a while?
Right. So that's, again, looking at your dinner as a discrete thing. Tonight I'm making chicken thighs and broccoli. Whereas if the broccoli's in, let's say it's August and there's tons of broccoli coming in, and you're going to take advantage of the fact that it's at its peak, it's the freshest. So let's say you make a broccoli dish for dinner, and then the stems you might put on water to soften up and then run through a food mill the next day. And then you have a nice broccoli stock, which you can freeze or you can preserve in a jar. Using a pressure canner, which is not that scary once you get used to it. They're very safe. So you expand what you do with that food beyond just what you're eating for dinner that night.
You even use the peach pit in that peach, which most of us would definitely throw out. You use it for jam.
Right. The pits and the skins are all make a really tasty, kind of slightly fuzzy tasting jam. It's really wonderful and cozy. I make that when I'm for some reason putting up or otherwise eating a lot of peaches. And I only make that in the summer. And there's a ton of peach peels and pits. And so I'll put up the jam at the same time. It has to sit. Those peels have to sit overnight in sugar and so on. So it's kind of perfect because I don't actually deal with it the day I peel the peaches, but the next day. And I always do these little preserving projects and these waste stream projects at the same time as I'm cooking dinner anyway. I mean, if it's going to be a big ordeal, you know, that's just not a 21st century reality, you know.
There are probably some people listening to this going, wow, great idea. I would love to use every single thing in my kitchen and not throw anything out. But
right.
My life is such that I have these traditions and this is how I do things and it's going to be hard for me to change like that. What would you say to somebody like that?
Right. So I hear that all the time. And so I think a totalitarian, you know, a wholesale approach is just not going to work. It doesn't make sense, you know. But if you want to start utilizing your food in a different way, what I usually recommend is take a look at what you buy on a regular basis. Because if you're buying tomatoes all the time, you know, maybe you should give home canning tomatoes a whirl. Because every time you make a dish with your home canned tomatoes, it's going to be qualitatively better than the commercial stuff. I don't care what the provenance is of the commercial. And when in the process of making your home canned tomatoes, you'll get all of this tomato water that comes off of it. And that tomato water is a byproduct that you can use in various dishes. So it only makes sense to look at the way you eat and slowly incorporate homemade ingredients into your kitchen that you use frequently. You know, I don't drink that many Bloody Marys, so I really don't need to make Worcestershire sauce if I buy it. You know, that's fine. The stuff lasts forever anyway. But I do eat a lot of tomatoes. I don't eat a lot of strawberry jam, so I don't can 12 half pints of strawberry jam. I just can as much as I'm going to eat from strawberry season in 2013 to strawberry season in 2014. So it's really like I think people just would benefit from just doing a little pantry intervention and saying, what do I really eat a lot of? And if I replace just that with homemade, then I've got it going.
Eugenia Bone, author of The Kitchen Ecosystem, Integrating Recipes to Create Delicious Meals. We've got some recipes from Eugenia at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Climbers are gathering at base camp on Mount Everest, preparing for the small window next month when they can summit the world's tallest mountain. And despite last year's avalanche that killed 16 Nepalese Sherpas, there are more climbers this year, including 30-year-old professional guide Melissa Arnott. She created a foundation, the Juniper Fund, to help the families of the Sherpas killed and create new opportunities for their children. Her climb will raise money for that, and she hopes make history. She's hoping to be the first American woman to summit without supplemental oxygen or traditional Sherpa porters. She joins us on a sat phone from base camp, 17,000 feet, so listen closely. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
And just can you describe what you are looking at?
So we're looking directly up at the climbing route. We have the new moon coming up around us, and the stars are pretty amazing.
Now, this is just incredible. I mean, just to give people a perspective, a lot of people, you know, get altitude sickness at around 11 or 12 and could never get to where you are, and you're about to start what's, you know, known as the climb. Look, terrible avalanche last year, terrible loss. You've been one of the people in the forefront of trying to make life better for Sherpas. You've started a foundation, but you were there that day when that avalanche occurred. What was your own gut feeling when this happened?
Oh, that was a horrible day. I mean, that was a day where the worst thing imaginable, the thing that we always fear and know can happen, did happen.
Did you know the Sherpas who were killed?
I did. I had 5 close friends that were killed.
Yeah. I mean, some would say, how can you go back to the mountain?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good question. And for me, it comes down to knowing that over the last 8 years of working here, I've learned so much about this place. And I feel like walking away at this really critical time would be somewhat irresponsible when I think the things I've learned can actually help usher Everest into a more sustainable and responsible time. And I am very interested in that. I love this place and the people that work here, and I want other people to be able to experience that, you know, enduring through time. And so I think if I just threw up my hands and said, I don't like what's happening, I become somewhat complicit in making this not a good place to be.
Well, and there's the way that you're planning to climb without oxygen and without Sherpa support. Now, we should explain there's going to be a Sherpa climbing with you, but not as, I don't know, there's no other way to put it, as a mule, as somebody who's burdened with your gear?
Yeah, exactly. So we have one Sherpa, Amiru, who's working with us, and he's helping our cameraman, who has an unbelievable task of trying to film what I'm doing as well as climb Everest at the same time. And so he's not going to be carrying loads for us. He's not setting up camp. We're just climbing as a normal climbing team as we would on any other expedition in any other place in the world.
Okay, well, just let's stay with this for a second. Do you worry that climbing without Sherpas in that area, as much as you support the Sherpas, will be the beginning of the end of what's been their life, what's been their only job path, being Sherpas?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that's a slight misconception is that I'm not hiring any staff personally for my trip, but the Sherpa support that's on the mountain is absolutely integral for me to be able to climb. There's teams of Sherpa who are fixing routes that every single climber, including myself, will use.
Fix the ropes, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, that job, I think, is definitely essential. And most people who are coming to climb Everest are still going to hire local workers. And for me, you know, I think I battle with the ethics of that. Is, do I want to endanger people's lives if I can do the work myself, or do I want to support their livelihood? And I think I'm constantly battling that question myself.
Well, now, the oxygen part. How do you train for that? You told the Today Show that you've been trying to put yourself in situations that would match, you know, not having that spark that you get from oxygen support. How do you do that?
Well, I think somebody told me early on in my climbing, you know, you don't need to practice suffering. And I think I found that that's not true at all. And you do just sort of have to practice suffering. And that idea that when you don't have supplemental oxygen, the first part of your body that starts to feel the effect of that is your brain. So putting on my boots in the morning here at base camp might take me 1 minute. But up at 26,000 feet without using supplemental oxygen, it could take me 25 to 45 minutes just to put on my boots.
Yeah. Well, and just one last question, Melissa. You obviously love this mountain. You've summited 5 times. You obviously love the people, investing in them. As you said, trying to make the mountain more sustainable. What do you say to people who say it can't be at this point? It's been so overrun. We should leave it alone.
Well, I just don't think that's entirely true. I think you have to see for yourself. Mount Rainier in Washington State, where I also work, you know, over 10,000 people climb Mount Rainier every single summer. And that's a very sustainable mountain. It's not overrun or overcrowded, and there aren't problems with garbage. This is the highest mountain in the world, and it's always going to be attractive to people. But I think every person has to say, am I conducting myself ethically here? Am I giving something to this place more than just taking? And if we all agree to do that, I think this can be a place that people can climb for generations to come.
Yeah. That's professional mountain guide Melissa Arnott. Hoping to become the first American woman to reach the top of Mount Everest without supplemental oxygen and without traditional Sherpa support. We've reached her at base camp by sat phone. Melissa, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.